You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're in Leimert Park at the historic plaza on Crenshaw, just outside of a large multi-purpose room that overlooks a park with open glass doors that look out onto the street. And there's a meeting going on inside, filled with a few rows of chairs, a stage for speakers, a crowd of about 60 people. They're here to talk politics. Local candidates for Congress, county supervisor, and city council are all here to meet them. 12 black political organizations have invited the South LA community to hear from those local candidates ahead of a primary and city council election that comes this Tuesday, Super Tuesday, March 3rd. Now, lots of people associate the black community with being loyally Democratic. For generations, most of the nation's black population has voted for Democrats. But that assumed allegiance has left some black voters feeling forgotten.
I gave them my vote for years, and then I didn't see anything change. You know, just, you know, what we hear today, people are, we're still fighting for the same things for the past 30, 40 years. And we're still voting for the same people, and we're expecting a different result. I think people are starting to recognize that they've been taken for granted.
Corin Rankin is a former bail bondswoman who's made it her mission to convert more black people from Democrats to Republicans. Rankin is black, and she's an avid Trump supporter who serves as an advisory board member on his Black Voices for Trump reelection initiative. KCRW's Cerise Castle spent a day with Rankin in Leimert Park to find out whether anyone is listening.
Corin Rankin wasn't always a Republican. She voted for Democrats for most of her life, but she was convinced the party wasn't doing much for her.
I was already disenfranchised with the Democratic Party. And then Barack Obama came along, and I was so inspired just, you know, by him. He was so, I bought into the hope and change just 100%. I felt like he got it, like he understood, like that he was going to kind of push back on the Democrat Party. And I was very disappointed because I didn't feel like he, once he was elected, that he was really fighting for me as a small business owner, as a middle-class American, and as a black person. And so that's when I started questioning, why am I a Democrat?
While Trump was campaigning in 2016, pundits didn't expect him to get a lot of support from the black community. But according to an analysis by the Center for American Progress, he received about 8% of the black vote in an election that saw an overall decrease in black voter turnout. But right now, black Americans aren't happy with his performance. In a Washington Post Ipsos poll last month, 83% of black Americans said Donald Trump is a racist. So this is an interesting time to try and convert black Americans to the Republican Party. Corin Rankin says she doesn't think that it's the president's responsibility to take on issues of race.
We live in a society that has racism. We've always had racism in this country in one form or another. So I always say that, you know, if we're looking to the president, be it Barack Obama, be it George Bush and Donald Trump, to solve racism, then that's our that's our first mistake.
Rankin says she focuses her messaging on what she says are Trump's efforts to uplift black people.
I mean, you can't argue with the lowest black unemployment levels in history. It's historic. What he's doing with the historically black colleges, that they're going to be permanently funded.
In December, Trump signed a bipartisan bill that will provide more than $250 million a year to the nation's historically black colleges.
He is making good on his promises, and that he has been helping the black community with, you know, the First Step Act, criminal justice reform, which is something that Barack Obama couldn't get done in 8 years. And President Donald Trump got it done within his first 6 months.
Rankin says the Democratic Party's lack of policies that improve black quality of life and the current field of Democratic presidential candidates are evidence that the Democrats don't prioritize black people.
I like to point out that the Democrats pride themselves on their diversity. They're like, we're diverse. And, you know, look what just happened in the last Democrat presidential candidates. The first people to fall out were the minorities. And so now you have a bunch of white people on the stage, wealthy white people on the stage, arguing over who has the most black support.
As he runs for re-election, President Trump is making appeals to the black community. He ran an ad during the Super Bowl touting his legislation on criminal justice reform and highlighted low unemployment figures in his State of the Union address. Corinne Rankin is happy that Trump is enthusiastic about getting black support, but she says that the California GOP doesn't share the sentiment. She claims that during their convention last year, the state party said that they wouldn't do any direct outreach to California's black residents, about 6% of the state's total population.
They presented data. The data showed that there's a small percentage of black people in the state of California, which is accurate data. And the data showed that black people in California overwhelmingly vote Democrat, which is true. And they made a business decision.
How did that make you feel?
Terrible. It made us all feel terrible, quite frankly. But we had two choices. We could sit around and feel terrible and complain about it to ourselves, or we can get up and do something about it, and we chose the latter.
So now she's on a mission to get black people to buy in. Last year, she founded the Legacy Republican Alliance, a social club and political action committee dedicated to supporting black Republican candidates across the country. That means she spends her weekends driving from her home in Redwood City to events like these in LA and talking to voters like this man.
Every elected official is a Democrat. I mean, everyone here is a Democrat. You get
except
one
Schwarzenegger.
Well, okay, but that does a lot.
Yeah, but what did he do?
Yeah.
Did he make it better? You're talking about the Democrats being bad and Republicans being better. What did Schwarzenegger do to make it better at all?
Because Rankin supports candidates like Joe Collins, who's making a speech here today. He's a Republican Navy vet from South Central who was going up against 15-term incumbent Maxine Waters.
Maxine Waters, she was really good back in the day. She did what she had to do, but her leadership style for where our country is going is ineffective. You know, we have to be able to provide opportunities for our youth, and we have to be able to take care of our senior citizens and rebuild our communities.
He says he thinks that Republican platforms line up with values in the black community, but people are unaware.
A lot of people in our community don't research. They hear something and they like it and they just go with it.
That something he's alluding to is racism. When I asked him directly about Trump's racist behavior, he said,
"It's none of my business."
None of your business?
Well, because everybody's ideals came about from how they were brought up. So if he's racist, I don't know about it, you know? But at the end of the day, I still will use this program to bring value to our district.
Collins got a warm response from the Leimert Park crowd. In fact, no one was openly dismissive of voting Republican. Eight people I spoke with said they were open to it. Harriet Barton says she's been politically active for over 40 years and is considering making some changes.
I had been Democrat my whole voting life, but I have registered independent, and I'm listening. So it depends on what they're saying. I'm not saying I would vote for Trump, but I'm open to someone that's addressing my needs and the needs of my community.
Still, Corinne Rankin has a lot of work to do. The Pew Research Center reported in 2018 that 84% of black voters identify with or lean toward the Democratic Party. For KCRW, I'm Cerise Castle.
Coming up, how LA County school districts are preparing for the possibility of the coronavirus. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Concern over the novel coronavirus, or COVID-19, is spreading at least as fast, if not faster, than the virus itself. There are more cases spreading outside of China and Japan, through Europe and the Middle East. Wall Street's taken another big hit today. And here in California, as of this morning, there are only 28 reported cases. Most of those are in Northern California. There's only been one confirmed case here in Los Angeles County. Nevertheless, local officials are bracing, and that includes school leaders. And we're going to talk to one of them right now. Deborah Duardo is superintendent of the L.A. County Office of Education. Superintendent, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Explain just for a moment, you oversee all of the school systems in the county, correct?
Correct. There are 80 districts in L.A. County, about 1.5 million students, and I work with all 80 districts.
We've only, however, just had one reported case in L.A. So far, but schools are petri dishes for viruses and sickness. So what are you telling those school systems?
Well, we're reminding everybody to not panic, that there's still only one case in L.A. County. However, we do have to be prepared. Just as we prepare for earthquakes and fires, we need to be prepared given the spread of this disease. So what we are telling them first and foremost is to practice good hygiene, stay home when they're sick, to continue to wash their hands frequently and to cover their mouths and nose, you know, when they're coughing, just kind of the common sense practices around not spreading any type of illness. But we're also reminding them that we want our schools to be safe. We want them to be welcoming. We don't want to stir up any unnecessary fear or anxiety amongst our children. So we're asking all the adults around them to make sure that they have the facts. And we're sending out, you know, regularly communicating with our parents and with our school districts what those facts are by having regular briefings with the Department of Public Health so that everybody understands kind of where we stand. But at the same time, we're taking steps to prepare. Should it get to a situation where we do need to close any of our schools, that we have online learning models available, other forms of instruction that children can take home to prepare them and to continue the learning. We really want to avoid any disruption in learning.
You guys have had to deal with some fake news as well, right? Like I remember a few weeks ago, somebody was going online mimicking some sort of news outlet saying that they had to close schools or there was a school district that was infected or something along those lines, right?
Yes, and that's unfortunate. Any type of fake news, you know, which creates more fear in our communities and in our schools. And, you know, that's what we've been very clear about, us not tolerating any type of bullying behavior, any stigmatization of any of our children or communities. We're just not going to tolerate that, and it's just unfortunate that some people are sending out that false information.
We've had outbreaks before. We've had flu outbreaks. We've had SARS and MRSA and Ebola. I mean, I can think of quite a few. Do you remember anything like this where you've had to sort of, you know, sorry for the bad line, but gird your loins, you know, when something like this happens?
I haven't seen anything that's created this much fear and paranoia, you know, but honestly, what we're doing is reminding people that we need to be consistent about the messaging that's going out there, that we need to have accurate information, that people are more at risk for, you know, being very sick or dying from the flu than they are the coronavirus, and that we just need to make sure that we are staying home when we're sick and that we're washing our hands frequently and doing the things that we know we need to do to prevent the spreading of any kind of illness.
Before you took over as superintendent there at the Office of Education, you were the director of Student Health and Human Services over at LAUSD, which I suspect prepared you to handle something like this. So what kind of advice do you give to parents in, you know, your districts?
You know, we've realized that parents are going to be concerned for their children. Obviously, they're the most important things to them. And what we want to remind them is that their safety and their health is our priority as well. And so what we do is we want to make sure that parents have accurate information, that we have forums where they can come in and express their concerns and hear from the experts in public health and in education to, you know, assure them that we're not hiding anything from them, that we're doing everything possible to make sure that their children are safe and healthy. We also need to make sure that they realize that children look to the adults around them to measure their level of safety. And so it's really important that adults are aware that their children are watching them and they're modeling the type of behavior that's appropriate given any kind of an emergency. We need to be prepared, and we are prepared if the event should occur, but there's no need to scare children or start thinking about closing down schools when we only have one case in LA County. And also, you know, what we know is that the people that have died from this disease and the people that have been most impacted are elderly people and people who have existing chronic conditions. So our school-age children are not the most at risk, especially not here in LA County. And I think schools are the safest place that any child can be if they're going to be out in public.
What advice do you give parents, though, who you know, are charged with talking to their kids about this stuff? Should they be talking to their kids about it? If so, what do they say?
They absolutely should be talking to their kids about it because their kids are hearing it. They're hearing it on the news. They're hearing it at school. So they need to speak to their children at a level that they can understand, that's age appropriate, and they need to give them correct information. They need to let them know that, yes, there is this illness that has spread in certain parts of the world and a few cases in our country. There's only one case in Los Angeles, and talking about how big Los Angeles is and that their risk of getting sick is very low. But there are some things that we can do to protect ourselves, like washing our hands and staying home when we're sick so we're not spreading any type of illness to others. But they also need to be talking to them about how we have to respect everyone. And just because somebody comes from China or they're Asian doesn't mean they're any more likely to spread this illness, and that we need to maintain order, and we need to go to school, and we need to learn, and we need to move on with our day-to-day lives.
Preparation, obviously, is the key. Do you think this is getting a bit overhyped in this country?
Well, I think given the fact that, especially for Los Angeles, that we only have one case, I think too much attention has been placed on this. I believe that we're still very low risk. And until we have reason to believe otherwise, I think we should all go about our day-to-day routines and go to school and go to work and practice good hygiene to prevent the spreading of any kind of illness. But until we have any reason to believe there's more of a threat here, I don't think there's a need to create an environment of panic or alarm or put more anxiety on children that already have it kind of tough day to day.
Deborah Duardo, superintendent of the L.A. County Office of Education, which oversees the districts in L.A. County. Thank you so much, Deborah. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, stocks took a big dive today, more than 4.5%. The Dow was down about almost 1,200 points today because of fears of the coronavirus across the globe. We'll cover that throughout the day today, obviously, on KCRW. Just ahead on this program, they creep and crawl, and they move slowly across the ground and soil. How one museum is celebrating snails. Next on Greater LA. Welcome back to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. They are tiny. They're slow. They live in a shell. And snails. Yes, snails. They're getting their due at the Natural History Museum of LA County with a project called SLIME. Oh yeah, they're slimy too. SLIME is the acronym for Snails and Slugs Living in Metropolitan Environments. It's a community science project dedicated to studying the biodiversity of Southern California's snails and slugs through crowdsourcing, a bona fide snail blitz, And who else would we talk to about snails and slugs than Leela Higgins, of course, who is Senior Manager for Community Science over at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. Leela, let's escargot, shall we? You see what I did there, escargot? Yeah. So what is, Leela, what is the difference between a snail and a slug?
Okay, so they're both gastropods, which means gastro meaning stomach, pod meaning foot. So they both have those stomach-like feet that they slime around on.
Right.
But you can most easily tell them apart because snails generally have a beautiful large shell that they live and protect themselves with on their backs. And slugs, on the other hand, have their shells either not at all or internally, and you can't see them.
So by and large, the shells are the difference.
Yes. It's a really easy way to tell the difference.
What kind of role do they play in the ecosystem? I mean, where are they on the food chain, right? And and what do they do to help the ecosystem?
So they're low on the food chain. They eat the dead and dying plant material on the ground. They may eat a few other things like other insects that are in the soil. They'll even eat some soil. They also get eaten by a lot of other creatures. But, you know, they're doing their snail and slug thing. And, eat, reproduce, find a mate. Just like us humans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what else can you do? I mean, and when I talk about community science and trying to get people, more Angelenos involved, crowdsourcing, if you will, what are we talking about?
So we are trying to get people out all over Southern California to take as many snail and slug photos as they can. Land snails and slugs only for this project. We want 1,500 observations. And it started on February 1st, our snail blitz, and it goes through March 31st. And this is the fifth year we've done it.
Yeah. This is like Coachella for snails.
It is exactly like that, and they party just as hard.
Do they really?
No.
No. All right. Is there like a VIP pass? No. When you've done this in the past, people have sent in pictures, obviously. What kind of pictures? What are the highlights of the things that you've learned and the things that you've seen?
Sometimes during snail blitz and in our slime project, we will get the very first photo, the very first documentation of a snail or a slug. We didn't know it was here. Our scientists didn't know it was here. The very first year of snail blitz in 2016, Gregory and Emily Hahn put a picture on Instagram of some snails, and it turned out that those snails had never before been found in Los Angeles County. And Jan Vandetti, our snail scientist, was able to go to their house, confirm that those snails were there, and then take a few for specimens and, again, write it up as a publication.
And it's that kind of, I mean, it doesn't sound very scientific, but it's that kind of research, right, where we learn about some of the snails that are indigenous, right, to Los Angeles and Southern California.
It is essential research. Scientists can't be everywhere, so people can do this in their backyards and maybe be the first time to find it. But there's also rare species that are here, and we need to document them.
And non-native ones that aren't supposed to be here and then really wreak havoc, right, on the ecosystem.
So the most common snail that we find in Southern California right now is the brown garden snail, which is the one that was introduced. They literally thought they were going to start farming it for escargot. And now that's the most common snail you'll find sliming across sidewalks in your backyard, eating your lettuce if you're a gardener.
The Center for Biological Diversity, and I thought this was fascinating, has said that mollusks, which include snails and slugs, right, are among the most at-risk animals on the planet. Explain that.
So they can't move very far, right? It's not like a bird or an insect that can fly. If a habitat starts to get destroyed or degraded, they could fly away, a bird or an insect. Snail or a slug, they can't. So they're kind of slowly moving around. So imagine if a development comes in and basically goes over this whole mountainside, and that's the only place that snail lived. Now it's extinct. And so, yes, we need to be really careful. And here in Southern California, there are snails that live here and nowhere else in the world.
All right. Well, you have until the end of March to do this, right, to submit your snail and slug photos to the Slime Project on iNaturalist. That's the app?
iNaturalist is the app, yes.
Okay. And you can download that for free.
Free.
Or your favorite social media platform, right, on the gram.
Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Okay. Using the hashtag SnailBlitz. That's Blitz with a Z. Leela Higgins, Senior Community Manager for Community Science over at the Natural History Museum of LA County. Leela, as always, great to have you here.
Thanks, Steve.
There's a contest, by the way, a photo contest for Snail Blitz. Winners, like best snail photo or rarest slug photo, will receive 4 general admission tickets to the Natural History Museum. This is exciting stuff. Just check it out at their website, because Snail Blitz is the bomb. That's going to do it for us today. Next week, let's just say it's going to be super, including Super Tuesday, Destination Crenshaw, which is more than a mile-long stretch of highlighting black history and activism in L.A. I hope you'll join us. We're online, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast there and share your thoughts. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great day.